This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Madeline Jenner, coming to you from Sydney on Gadigal land. Welcome to This Week. It's the defamation case that's dominated headlines.
Brittany Higgins has broken down several times in a Sydney court. She was recounting her allegations about being raped at Parliament House in Canberra.
Bruce Lehrman has told a defamation trial he had no idea he was the subject of Brittany Higgins' allegations when he first read a news story about the rape claims.
Former federal Liberal political staffer Bruce Lehrman is suing Network 10 over coverage of allegations he raped his former colleague Brittany Higgins in Parliament House. This is a civil defamation case, but in some ways it's mirrored the original criminal case, which was abandoned. There have been no findings against Bruce Lehrman, who maintains his innocence. The ABC's Elizabeth Byrne has been watching in court this week.
This case is about Bruce Lehrman suing Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson over an interview they did with Brittany Higgins in March 2021, where she alleged that she had been raped on a couch inside the office of Linda Reynolds at Parliament House in 2019. She didn't name Bruce Lehrman in that interview, but he now says that he was defamed by that, and he's able to claim that he was defamed, although that's not accepted by the court yet, because he was tried and there was no resolution to the trial, as we know. It was abandoned. So that's what prompted his defamation action in the federal court.
Now, Channel 10 is in part using the truth defence, and that means we've been hearing a great deal again of the original allegations, right?
That's right, we have. And to start with, this case has run a little bit differently to others that I've sat through, where Bruce Lehrman's case was first, and then this week we've seen Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson's case, and that is relying very heavily on the evidence of Brittany Higgins retelling her story about what she says happened that night.
So Brittany Higgins has been in court this week. We've seen her cross-examination as well. What have we heard this week from Brittany Higgins?
Well, she's detailed what happened on the night, how she invited Bruce Lehrman to drinks with some colleagues, and that was a group that she said that was a group of people who were involved in the same kind of work that they were. And she said she'd felt like in that office that she'd only just joined, a bit like they thought she was the receptionist. She was at the bottom of the heap. And when she invited him to that night and he came, she felt more like an equal, that she'd earned some respect. But of course, as we've seen in the video, she drank a lot and many of those drinks were bought by Bruce Lehrman. And then later they went to Parliament House. She says she doesn't know why she got out of the car at Parliament House. She said she was quite inebriated and she had assumed she was just going home. That Bruce Lehrman and Brittany Higgins and a couple of other people went from the original pub where they were, the Dock, to a nightclub in Canberra City on the way. And it was after they were there that they went to Parliament House.
There were some pretty tense scenes in court when Brittany Higgins was under cross-examination by Bruce Lehrman's lawyer. He suggested she made up the rape allegations.
Yes, he suggested she may have done that because she wanted to save her job. So a couple of days after this incident, Bruce Lehrman was called into the Chief of Staff's office. He was accused of breaching security by coming in so late at night, and he hadn't had his pass or anything. He'd had to get a temporary pass. And he'd already been reprimanded over a fairly sort of, well, I suppose they don't see it as minor, but it was, he'd left a document face up on a desk which was supposed to be secure, and he'd already been spoken to about that. And this was the final straw. He left that office, packed up his stuff and left, ignoring instructions to come back and speak to the Chief of Staff before he left. And then Brittany Higgins was asked into the office. Now, she says that's when she first said that something sexual had happened, although there is some dispute, and this will come out later in this hearing, about whether she told someone then or whether it was a couple of days later. So that's still to be determined.
We've also heard this week from Bruce Lehrman himself, and he has been cross-examined, right, which we didn't get in the original rape case.
Yes, that's right. And in the original case, I mean, he could have made himself available for questioning, but he had a right to silence, as you do in a criminal trial. We did hear from him because we heard his police interview played to the court. He'd told various stories to various people about why he'd gone into Parliament. He told the security guard he had to pick up some documents or something. He told the chief of staff he'd come back to drink whiskey, but he told the police he'd come back to pick up his keys. So we did hear that in the trial, but we never heard him questioned or challenged about that evidence at all, and this time we have.
And we should add that there have also been discrepancies in Brittany Higgins' version of events. Is that right?
Yes, we have. And one of those, of course, was the bruise on her leg. She initially said that it happened during the alleged sexual assault, but now she's conceded, well, it might have happened when she fell on the stairs in the nightclub. But the thing that the court has really focused on has been whether she was still wearing her dress when she woke up in the morning. Her position was always that the dress was around her waist, but there was a security guard who maintained she found her naked on the couch when she checked in the middle of the night. So that led to some of the very intense and emotional exchanges between Brittany Higgins and Bruce Lehrman's lawyer.
Now, this is a judge-only case. There's no jury here. So what do we expect in coming weeks?
Well, it's interesting because in the trial, the test, of course, is beyond reasonable doubt. And we never got to that because the jury was dismissed because of the juror's misconduct. But in this case, the judge only has to weigh up the balance of probabilities. It's a completely different test. And also it's meant that there's been a very thorough examination of both parties. So we found out all sorts of stuff that we never knew before. And all sorts of areas have been explored, including Brittany Higgins' plans for a book. And she's pledged to give if she ever finishes it, any proceeds will go to charity. Those sorts of exchanges were happening. So it's quite different to the criminal trial, a different atmosphere altogether.
ABC reporter Elizabeth Byrne. At this time of year, global leaders gather to discuss the climate at the United Nations Climate Meeting, also known as the COP. This year, like many others, it comes after some extreme weather events and climate records.
The era of global warming has ended. The era of global boiling has arrived.
Rescue workers in Libya have called for more body bags after the country's catastrophic flood killed thousands of people.
With wildfires ravaging Greece, Canada and Algeria and simultaneous heatwaves searing the Northern Hemisphere, July 2023 will be Earth's hottest month on record.
Entire neighbourhoods wiped out. The heart of Lahaina, its once bustling front street, now a wasteland.
Our home has burnt down. We were in it since 1990. There's nothing left. We can't even go back to see. We literally only have the clothes on our back.
But while these meetings always lead to plenty of discussion about the ways to address climate change, the progress is often mixed. The 28th annual United Nations Climate Meeting has just kicked off in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, one of the world's top fossil fuel producing nations. So will it lead to greater action on climate change? Richie Merzian is the International Director at the Smart Energy Council. He's been to plenty of these meetings, but says this one is particularly important because it will be the first global stocktake of whether the world is on track to meet the Paris Agreement, capping global warming to 1.5 degrees.
This one is the first time they've ever actually done a proper stocktake of our progress since the big, important agreement in 2015. That global stocktake report came out early this year. Has numerous recommendations about what we need to be doing. It's no surprise that we're not keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees. So it has recommendations for how we improve that, including what countries need to do in bringing forward new targets over the next year and a half. And hopefully we see more ambition actually built in and we see more finance to go with it, because a number of developing countries, poorer countries, want to take more action, just don't have the resources to do it. So we need both. We need ambition, but we also need the resources alongside it.
And as this meeting begins, we've already seen some announcements with delegates agreeing to launch a long-awaited fund to pay for damage from climate-driven storms and drought. Is that significant? And perhaps is that a sign that there might be a fair bit of movement at this meeting?
It is significant. For a long time, we've avoided those hard conversations that we will not be able to address climate change sufficiently to avoid some extreme impacts. And so what do you do with that loss and damage? Now, in Australia, you can insure yourself against that, but in many developing countries, they don't have private insurance that covers that. Who's going to pay for that loss and damage? And so finally, after about 30 years of UN climate work, a new dedicated fund for loss and damage has been set up, a trustee has been appointed, and at this COP, hopefully we'll see countries tip finance in so that those countries like Vanuatu, that was hit three times this year with tropical cyclones, has the resources available to actually deal with those consequences.
Another thing on the agenda is a new renewable energy target. What are we expecting there?
The International Energy Agency says if we want to keep to net zero by 2050, then not only do we have to phase down fossil fuels, we have to massively ramp up renewables. You need to build those clean energy sources that are going to replace them. And so for the first time ever, we're considering a global goal on renewable energy build, and that is to triple renewable energy capacity by 2030 and to double down on energy efficiency. So how are we smarter with our energy use and how do we build more clean energy? We can do so locally, and we're tripling our renewables in Australia, and we can do so globally by leading on this ambition. And I'm hopeful that that'll be one of the big outcomes at Dubai.
The phase out of fossil fuels has been a sticking point at these meetings for some time. Are you hopeful anything will move there at this COP?
I mean, this is the real controversy, right? We're going to be trying to address the main source of greenhouse gas emissions, which is coal, oil, and gas when it's dug up and burnt. And one of the major exporters, one of the countries that has profited the most from fossil fuels is the United Arab Emirates. Having said that, the COP president has said that it is inevitable that we need to move away from fossil fuels, that it's essential that we find a pathway to do so. And there'll be a big push by countries like those in the Pacific, like a number of European leaders, to actually get language in there on the need to phase down fossil fuels as soon as possible to stop new investments in fossil fuel projects, which is essential if we actually want to keep to net zero by 2050. So this will be a big discussion point. Probably expect a big Barney on the floor about this.
Yet there were also reports this week of plans for oil deals on the sidelines of the meeting. Does that really give you much hope?
No, look, it's disappointing. I mean, unfortunately, the UN system is all we have, and it is really just our best efforts to try and get sovereign nations to do the right thing. And sometimes they blur the lines, they try and have it both ways. And these reports around the COP president also spruiking oil, as well as spruiking renewables, as well as spruiking climate deals, is disappointing. But you do have a record number of people going. You have a lot of action that is going to be taking place, not just in the negotiating room between countries, but also between industries, between unions, between NGOs, between charities, all pushing for climate action. Upwards of 60, 70,000 people come. And that, it just shows you the massive global push from the grassroots upwards to finally have the kind of ambition we need to basically align with the science. And so whilst it's disappointing, I think the process is bigger. I think the push is bigger, and I think we'll still get some progress.
How does Australia look coming into this year's meeting? We've not exactly been applauded for our stance in the past.
No, look, Australia's been a laggard in the past. You know, it's one of the largest fossil fuel exporters in the world, and it's been known for protecting its fossil fuel interests above global interests. But in the last couple of years, the Albanese government has taken our target from 26% to 43%. They've put in place more policies to actually meet our climate ambition. Just this week, the climate minister put forward the annual statement that shows that we are generally on track to hit that target. But there are some areas that we need to do better. So one example is transport. In transport, we still drive some of the most inefficient vehicles in the world. Only Australia and Russia don't have a minimum level of efficiency for the vehicles that we have. So we're importing these gas guzzlers. And that's just a simple way, a simple policy the government could bring forward that would make sure that we can actually start turning our transport emissions around. So there's still lots of area of work for Australia to progress. However, we're certainly going in the right direction under this current government.
And am I right in thinking there's no host yet for next year's meeting? Is that problematic at this point?
Yeah, look, it is problematic. You're quite right. Next year, it's supposed to be in Eastern Europe, but because of the conflicts, you know, between Ukraine and Russia, between Azerbaijan and Armenia, the Eastern Europeans haven't been able to agree on who's going to host. So it could very well default to the headquarters, which is in Bonn, Germany. The year after, we're going to see it in Brazil, and that'll be a big, important COP that will take place in the Amazon, where countries will bring forward new targets for 2035. And fingers crossed, in 2026, we could be seeing a COP take place in Australia, hosted by Australia and the Pacific in partnership. And that would be, I think, one of the biggest, most powerful moments to transition this country that we've ever had.
You've worked in this space for a long time and you've been to a lot of these meetings. It feels like there's often a big build-up, some powerful speeches, and then not necessarily a lot of action. How do you stay optimistic about this process?
Maybe I'm just a bit of a fool. Really, I see the UN process as the best that we can muster up, despite all the dramas. Like, if we think about how hard climate action has been in Australia, and you multiply that by 196 countries, and on top of that, everyone in the UN climate space has to agree on everything. It's consensus-based decision-making. And despite all those hurdles, we got the Paris Agreement that took us from basically greenhouse gas emissions that were shooting up to 4 degrees down to more like 3 degrees. The last couple of years, we've seen targets move that closer to 2 degrees. We've seen progress slowly, slowly, incrementally over the years. That's the pace of diplomacy, but it's the only system that we have to get a global deal on what is a global problem. And so I guess I just bank those incremental wins and recognize the system as being flawed, but the best that we have, and we just need to chip away at it, and that's all we can do.
Richie Merzian, the International Director of the Smart Energy Council. It was a daring rescue attempt in a remote mountain tunnel in northern India. But this week, amazingly, 41 construction workers walked out alive and well.
It was a very challenging task in which our brothers in labour were struggling inside continuously for more than 16 days, and the whole country was struggling outside for them.
They'd been trapped for 17 days following a tunnel collapse. And while plenty of questions have been raised about the safety of what they were doing in the tunnel in the first place, there were jubilant scenes as they finally emerged.
It was like 1.4 billion people were in the tunnel, because we were doing this obviously underground. And everyone was just cheering, and all these men just came jumping out. They were like jumping around and hands in the air, and then the crowd starts cheering.
Arnold Dix is an engineering professor and the president of the International Tunnelling and Underground Space Association. As authorities grappled with how to get the men out, he was called in to help.
And I was apparently, I know this will come as a real shock, but I must have got something in my eye, because apparently I was crying. And one of the family guys turns to me, he's like pointing to me, "You okay? You got something in your eye?" And I'm like, ugh. So I smarten myself up. I'm like, yes, yes, me tough man. And it was an unbelievable moment, because, see, for me, I knew until I had until we had the 41 people out, it wasn't done, because the whole thing could have come down and, you know, the result could have been very different any second. And so I was busy counting 1, 2, 3, like as they're all bouncing around. And that was hard, because the crowd was like, well, it's like a footy grand final with everyone sort of swarming everywhere. But once I got to 41, I was like, done, we're done. No one's hurt, so I was happy.
And, I mean, you mentioned how potentially difficult this was because they were in a very remote area, right?
When I say remote, I mean I got choppered in. It's the Himalayas, and not only is it the Himalayas, it's the section they call the Valley or the Land of the Gods. So it's the most sacred area for the Hindu people. It is just unbelievably, awesomely breathtaking, but remote. So it's hard enough to get a car up there. It's really little roads. Sometimes they're made, sometimes they're not. They're often collapsing with avalanches, so you're dodging avalanche material, big rocks, everything like that.
Obviously, there was a very happy ending, but were you always confident that they would get out, that they could be got out?
I actually thought we were going to get them out, and it sounds really odd, but when I arrived, I didn't know, right? And then I went to the site and I had a look, and then I met the people and I met the team, everybody. Like, on paper, it looked really stuffed. It had all the signatures of it's going to be, I think I've used the word tomb. And they were a bit depressed when I turned up, everyone, because they'd gone a few days, and I thought, you know what, I reckon we're going to do this. I've got a really good feeling about it. I reckon we're going to do it. But I just had no idea how. And so I figured, well, we'll figure that out. But if we can hold that line that we're going to get them out and we're not in a rush, we've been able to get this little pipe in, and we were able to fire like peanuts and things at them. It was like a little pipe. It wasn't big enough for big food, but, you know, we could put rations in. They're not going to die, at least not straight away. So we've got some time to be really clever.
Well, because there were even some setbacks even once you got there. You know, key pieces of machinery failed, and in the end they were basically dug out by hand almost, right?
Oh, yeah. We had huge setbacks. Everything was failing. And not only that, and I can talk about it now, I couldn't talk about it then, all of our data. So we were getting, there was a satellite showing how things were moving. More importantly, we had some drones that were running almost real-time 3D modelling of what was happening on our side. And what we could see is that the whole thing was collapsing. So my predictions were looking a bit bleak. So again, being a glass half full kind of guy, we kind of got this strategy, let's just pump as much food in there as we can, because if it collapses, say we can give them a month's food, then even though the rest of the outside world will think we've failed, we'll still be able to get them out because they'll still have food and we've got other ways to get in there. So, yeah, no, we didn't just have setbacks. Like, we were teetering on a catastrophic failure of the whole thing coming down again. But on the other hand, we were convinced that we're going to figure it out. And so what we were doing as a group, what we collectively did, what the this really positive spirit that we developed amongst us all, was we didn't rely on any one thing. Even though the press was going off its chop, we were systematically, carefully following this mission, and the mission was 41 men home safe. So no crazy behaviour, no look at me, I'm a hero, no none of that stuff, just let's go. And in the end, it's the softly that did it. It's the putting a man down a pipe with his hands, millimeters by millimeters, tickling the rock and just quietly popping out the other side, and then everyone scurrying out. So, yeah.
I'm presuming you've done this kind of work before, and perhaps not always with such a happy ending. How does it feel to be involved in a disaster recovery that's gone perfectly, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I feel good, as they say. I feel good. But what I'm so struck by is what great things can be done when nice people do good things. I don't know how else to say it than that. Look, I look at the world at the moment, and it's just completely nuts. It didn't matter that I'm like a pink non-Hindu person here. I was just here to help, you know. Okay, so I'm not a vegetarian, but hell, I can have my schnitzel when I get home, you know. And we did great things. And this is showing what really good human beings do. And it's showing how we look after each other and what we can do doing it instead of this spiral of hatred and, oh, anyway, I'm so disgusted with my own world at the moment, and I'm so happy to be part of this that I've just done.
Arnold Dix, an engineering professor. And that's the episode for this week. Subscribe by searching for the This Week podcast. It's produced by Laura Corrigan, Anna John, and me, Madeline Jenner. Catch you next time.